Chapter 41 Avasarala. After the Guan Chi Yin, the Rocinante seemed dour, mean, and utilitarian. There was no plush carpeting, only fabric-covered foam to soften corners and angles where soldiers might be thrown when the ship maneuvered violently. Instead of cinnamon and honey, the air had the plastic and heat smell of military air recyclers. And there was no expansive desk, no wide, solitaire-ready bed, and no private space apart from a captain's lounge the size of a public toilet stall. Most of the footage they'd taken had been in the cargo bays, angled so that no ammunition or weaponry was in the image. Someone who knew Martian military vessels could tell where they were. To everyone else, it would be an open space with cargo crates in the background. Naomi Nagata had helped put the release together. She was a surprisingly good visual editor, and when it became clear that none of the men could manage a professional-sounding voiceover, she'd done that too. The crew assembled in the medical bay, where the mechanic, Amos Burton, had changed the feed to display from her hand terminal. Now he was sitting on one of the patient beds, his legs crossed, smiling amiably. If Avasarala hadn't seen the intelligence files on Holden's crew, she'd never have guessed what the man was capable of. The others were spread out in a rough semicircle. Bobby was sitting beside Alex Kamal, the Martians unconsciously grouping together. Praxidiki Mung stood at the back of the room. Avasarala couldn't tell if her presence made him uncomfortable or if he was always like that. "Okay," she said. "Last chance for feedback." "We shared some popcorn," Amos said, and the medical scanners flashed once, showing a broadcast code and then white block letters for immediate release. Avasarala and Holden appeared on the screen. She was speaking, her hands out before her as if illustrating a point. Holden looked sober, leaned toward her. Naomi Nagata's voice was calm, strong, and professional. In a surprising development, the deputy to Undersecretary of Executive Administration, Sadavir Ehrenreich, met with OPA Representative James Holden and a representative of the Martian military today to address concerns over the potentially earth-shattering revelations surrounding the devastating attack on Ganymede. The image cut to Avasarala. She was leaning forward to make her neck longer and hide the loose skin under her chin. Long practice made her look natural, but she could almost hear Arjun laughing. A runner at the bottom of the screen identified her by name and title. "I expect to be traveling with Captain Holden to the Jovian system," Avasarala said. "The United Nations of Earth feel very strongly that a multilateral investigation into this is the best way to restore balance and peace to the system." The image shifted to Holden and Avasarala sitting in the galley with the botanist. This time, the little scientist was talking, and she and Holden pretended to listen. The voiceover came again. "When asked about the accusations leveled against Praxidike Mung, whose search for his daughter has become the human face of the tragedy on Ganymede, the Earth delegation was unequivocal." Then, back to Avasarala, her expression now sorrowful, her head shaking in an almost subliminal negation. "Nicola Mulco is a tragic figure in this, and I personally condemn the irresponsibility of these raw news feeds that allow statements from mentally ill people to be presented as if they were verified fact. Her abandonment of her husband and child is beyond dispute, and her struggles with her psychological issues deserve a more dignified and private venue." From off-camera, Nagata asked, "So you blame the media?" "Absolutely," Avasarala said as the image shifted to a picture of a toddler with smiling black eyes and dark pigtails. "We have absolute faith in Dr. Mung's love and dedication to May, and we are pleased to be part of the effort to bring her safely home." The recording ended. "All right," Avasarala said. "Any comments?"
"I don't actually work for the OPA anymore," Holden said.
"I'm not authorized to represent the Martian military," Bobby said. "I'm not even sure I'm still supposed to be working with you."
"Thank you for that. Are there any comments that matter?" Avasarala asked. There was a moment's silence. Worked for me, Praxidiki Mung said. There was one way that the Rocinante was infinitely more expansive than the Guan Chi Yin, and it was the only one that she cared about. The tight beam was hers. Lag was worse, and every hour took her farther from Earth, but knowing that the messages she sent were getting off the ship without being reported to Nguyen and Ehrenreich gave her the feeling of breathing free. What happened once they reached Earth, she couldn't control. But that was always true. That was the game. Admiral Souther looked tired, but on the small screen it was hard to tell much more than that. You've kicked the beehive, Christian, he said. It's looking an awful lot like you just made yourself a human shield for a bunch of folks that don't work for us. And I'm guessing that was the plan. I did what you asked, and yes, Nguyen took meetings with Jules Pierre Mao. First one was just after his testimony on Protogen. And yes, Ehrenreich knew about them. But that doesn't mean very much. I've met with Mao. He's a snake. But if you stopped dealing with men like him, you wouldn't have much left to do. The smear campaign against your scientist friend came out of the executive office, which I've got to say makes a damn lot of us over here in the armed forces a bit twitchy. Starts looking like there's divisions inside the leadership, and it gets a little murky whose orders we're supposed to be following. If it gets there, our friend Ehrenreich still outranks you. Him or the Secretary General comes to me with a direct order, I'm going to have a hell of a good reason to think it's illegal. This whole thing smells like skunk, but I don't have that reason yet. You know what I'm saying? The recording stopped. Avasarala pressed her fingers to her lips. She understood. She didn't like it, but she understood. She levered herself up from her couch. Her joints still ached from the race to the Rocinante, and the way the ship would sometimes shift beneath her. Course corrections, moving gravity a degree or two, left her vaguely nauseated. She'd made it this far. The corridor that led to the galley was short, but it had a bend just before it entered. The voices carried well enough that Avasarala walked softly. The low Martian drawl was the pilot, and Bobby's vowels in timbre were unmistakable. That telling the captain where to stand and how to look. I thought Amos was going to toss her in the airlock a couple of times. He could try, Bobby said. And you work for her? I don't know who the hell I work for anymore. I think I'm still pulling a salary from Mars, but all my dailies are out of her office budget. I've pretty much been playing it all as it comes. Sounds rough. I'm a Marine, Bobby said. And Avasarala paused. The tone was wrong. It was calm, almost relaxed, almost at peace. That was interesting. Does anyone actually like her? The pilot asked. No, Bobby said, almost before the question was done being asked. Oh, hell no. And she keeps it like that. That shit she pulled with Holden, marching on his ship and ordering him around like she owned it? She's always like that. The Secretary General? She calls him a bobblehead to his face. And what's with the potty mouth? Part of her charm, Bobby said. The pilot chuckled, and there was a little slurp as he drank something. I may have misunderstood politics, he said. And a moment later, you like her? I do. Mind if I ask why? We care about the same things, Bobby said. And the thoughtful note in her voice made Avasarala feel uncomfortable eavesdropping. She cleared her throat and walked into the galley. Where's Holden? She asked. Probably sleeping, the pilot said. The way we've been keeping the ship's cycles, about 2 in the morning. Ah, Avasarala said. For her, it was mid-afternoon. That was going to be a little awkward. Everything in her life seemed to be about lag right now. Waiting for the messages to get through the vast blackness of the vacuum. But at least she could prepare. I'm going to want a meeting with everyone on board as soon as they're up, she said. Bobby, you'll need your formal wear again. It took Bobby only a few seconds to understand. "You'll show them the monster," she said. "And then we're going to sit here and talk until we figure out what exactly it is they know on this ship. But has the bad guys worried enough they're willing to send their boys to kill them?" she said.
"Yeah, about that," the pilot said. "Those destroyers cut back to a cruising acceleration, but they aren't turning back yet."
"Doesn't matter," Avasarala said. "Everybody knows I'm on this ship. No one's going to shoot at it." In the local morning, and Avasarala's subjective early evening, the crew gathered again. Rather than bring the whole powered suit into the galley, she'd copied the stored video and given it to Naomi. The crew members were bright and well-rested, apart from the pilot, who had stayed up entirely too late talking to Bobby, and the botanist, who looked like he might just be permanently exhausted. "I'm not supposed to show this to anyone," Avasarala said, looking pointedly at Holden. "But on this ship right now, I think we all need to put our cards on the table, and I'm willing to go first. This is the attack on Ganymede, the thing that started it all off. Naomi?" Naomi started the playback, and Bobby turned away and stared at the bulkhead. Avasarala didn't watch it either, her attention on the faces of the others. As the blood and carnage played out behind her, she studied them and learned a little more about the people she was dealing with. The engineer, Amos, watched with the calm reserve of a professional killer. No surprise there. At first, Holden, Naomi, and Alex were horrified, and she watched as Alex and Naomi slid into a kind of shock. There were tears in the pilot's eyes. Holden, on the other hand, curled in. His shoulders bent outward from each other, and an expression of banked rage smoldered in his eyes and around the corners of his mouth. That was interesting. Bobby wept openly with her back to the screen, and her expression was melancholy, like a woman at a funeral, a memorial service. Praxidiki, everyone else called him Prax, was the only one who seemed almost happy. When, at the segment's end, the monstrosity detonated, he clapped his hands and squealed in pleasure. "That was it," he said. "You were right, Alex. Did you see how it was starting to grow more limbs? Catastrophic restraint failure. It was a failsafe."
"Okay," Avasarala said. "Why don't you try that again with an antecedent? What was a failsafe?"
"The other protomolecule form ejected the explosive device from its body before it could detonate. You see, these things, protomolecule soldiers or whatever, are breaking their programming, and I think Marion knows about it. He hasn't found a way to stop it because the constraints fail."
"Who's Marion? And what does she have to do with anything?" Avasarala said.
"You wanted more nouns, Grandma," Amos said.
"Let me take this from the top," Holden said, and recounted the attack by the stowaway beast, the damage to the cargo door, Prax's scheme to lure it out of the ship and reduce it to its component atoms with the drive's exhaust. Avasarala handed over the data she had about the energy spikes on Venus, and Prax grabbed that data, looking it over while talking about his determination of a secret base on Io where the things were being produced. It left Avasarala's head spinning.
"And they took your kid there?"
Avasarala said.
"They took all of them," Prax said.
"Why would they do that?"
"Because they don't have immune systems," Prax said. "And so they'd be easier to reshape with the protomolecule. There would be fewer physiological systems fighting against the new cellular constraints, and the soldiers would probably last a lot longer."
"Jesus, Doc," Amos said. "They're going to turn May into one of those fucking things?"
"Probably," Prax said, frowning. "I only just figured that out."
"But why do it at all?" Holden said. "It doesn't make sense."
"In order to sell them to a military force is a first strike weapon," Avasarala said. "To consolidate power before, well, before the fucking apocalypse."
"Point of clarification," Alex said, raising his hand. We have an apocalypse coming? Was that a thing we knew about?
Venus, Avasarala said.
Oh, that apocalypse, Alex said, lowering his hand. Right.
Soldiers that can travel without ships, Naomi said. You could fire them off at high G for a little while, then cut engines and let them go ballistic. How would you find them?
But it won't work, Prax said. Remember? They escape constraint. And since they can share information, they're going to get harder to hold to any kind of new programming.
The room went silent. Prax looked confused.
They can share information?
Avasarala said.
Sure.
Prax said. Look at your energy spikes. The first one happened while the thing was fighting Bobby and the other Marines on Ganymede. The second spike came when the other one got loose in the lab. The third spike was when we killed it with the Rocinante. Every time one of them has been attacked, Venus reacted. They're networked. I'd assume that any critical information could be shared, like how to escape constraints.
If they use them against people, Holden said. There won't be any way to stop them. They'll ditch the fail-safe bombs and just keep going. The battles won't end.
No, Prax said. That's not the problem. It's the cascade again. Once the protomolecule gets a little freedom, it has more tools to erode other constraints, which gets it more tools to erode more constraints, and on like that. The original program, or something like it, will eventually swamp the new program. They'll revert.
Bobby leaned forward. Her head canted a few degrees to the right. Her voice was quiet, but it had a threat of violence that was louder than shouting.
So, if they set those things loose on Mars, they stay soldiers like the first one for a while, and then they start dropping the bombs out like your guy did. And then they turn Mars into Eros?
Well, worse than Eros, Prax said.
Any decent-sized Martian city is going to have an order of magnitude more people than Eros did.
The room was quiet. On the monitor, Bobby's suit camera looked up at a star-filled sky while battleships killed each other in orbit.
I've got to send some messages out, Avasarala said.
These half-human things you've made, they aren't your servants. You can't control them, Avasarala said. Jules-Pierre Mao sold you a bill of goods. I know why you kept me out of this, and I think you're a fucking moron for it, but put it aside. It doesn't matter now. Just do not pull that fucking trigger. Do you understand what I'm saying? Don't. You will be personally responsible for the single deadliest screw-up in the history of humankind, and I'm on a ship with Jim fucking Holden, so the bar's not low.
The full recording clocked in at almost half an hour. The security footage from the Rocinante with its stowaway was attached. A 15-minute lecture by Prax had to be scrapped when he reached the part about his daughter being turned into a protomolecule soldier, and this time broke into uncontrollable weeping. Avasarala did her best to recapitulate it, but she wasn't at all certain she had the details right. She'd considered bringing John Michael into it, but decided against it. Better to keep it in the family. She sent the message. If she knew Aaron right, he wouldn't get back to her immediately. There would be an hour or two of evaluation, weighing what she'd said, and then, when she'd been left to stew for a while, he'd reply. She hoped he'd be sane about it. He had to. She needed to sleep. She could feel the fatigue gnawing at the edges of her mind, slowing her. But when she lay down, rest felt as far away as home, as Arjun. She thought about recording a message for him, but it would only have left her feeling more powerfully isolated. After an hour, she pulled herself up and walked through the halls. Her body told her it was midnight, or later, and the activity on board, music ringing out of the machine shop, a loud conversation between Holden and Alex about maintenance of the electronic systems, even Praxiticus sitting in the galley by himself, apparently grooming a box of hydroponics cuttings,
had a surreal, late-night feeling. She considered sending another message to Souther. The lag time would be much less to him, and she was hungry enough for a response that anything would do. When the answer came, it wasn't a message.
"Captain," Alex said over the ship-wide comm, "you should come up to Ops and look at this."
Something in his voice told Avasarala that this wasn't a maintenance question. She found the lift to Ops just as Holden went up and pulled herself up the ladder rather than wait. She wasn't the only one who'd followed the call. Bobby was in a spare seat, her eyes on the same screen as Holden's. The blinking tactical data scrolled down the screen and a dozen bright red dots displayed changes. She didn't understand most of what she saw, but the gist was obvious. The destroyers were on the move.
"Okay," Holden said. "What are we seeing?"
"All the Earth destroyers hit high burn, 6G, Alex said.
"Are they going to Io?"
"Oh, hell no."
This was Ehrenreich's answer. No messages, no negotiations, not even an acknowledgement that she'd asked him to restrain himself. Warships. The despair only lasted for a moment. Then came the anger.
"Bobby."
"Yeah?"
"That part where you told me I didn't understand the danger I was in?
And you told me that I didn't know how the game was played.
That part."
"I remember. What about it?"
"If you wanted to say, I told you so, this looks like the right time."